about the church in Philadelphia. Now you're thinking, wow, this is awfully convenient. This is one in the United States over on the East Coast. And gosh, I hadn't heard this before. Different Philadelphia, actually. And there's a map that's in the center that will alert you to that. I've tried to include, by the way, I tried to put my geek notes into the center section. I'm finding use for these pictures because now I can put bigger geek notes in there. And so, it's interesting. The original church or the original city of Philadelphia and how it came to be and the brotherly love, philos, the word philos, which is where we get the phila for Delphia, and then brother that comes, Adelphos is brother. And so you put those words together and you get Philadelphia, the city of brotherly love. Most of us know that already, but this is the story that it actually comes from originally. And the city in the United States of Philadelphia, which was actually founded by a very, very religiously dedicated group of people who not only made a treaty with the British so that they could have that area, but also made a treaty with the American Indians that were in the area. And so they became known as a city of brotherly love because they were not only okay with the motherland, but they were also okay with the locals. And so they became known as a very loving area and a very loving city. So that is how our Philadelphia got started over in, Pennsylvania. But the original Philadelphia is the one we're reading about here. And the story of that is right inside next to the map, which shows you where it is. It's the sixth of seventh churches. Next week, we'll be talking about Laodicea, the hot, the cold, the spit you out of your mouth church. And so a little more popular, Revelation 3:20, probably the most popular verse that most of us are familiar with. Behold, I stand at the door and knock. You remember that verse? We're going to be talking about that next week. So all that is coming. Right now, though, we are in the Church of Philadelphia. And Philadelphia was located, as you can see on that map on the inside, in the middle, right? On the postal road that ran through Asia Minor. It was a perfect location, by the way, for commerce, number one, letter A. The city was known as the gateway to the east. So all that stuff that's off to the east, you usually came to Philadelphia, and then you went east from there to do commerce and trade, and all the people from the east would come and roll into Philadelphia. Laodicea is actually a dinky little church, even though it's a really interesting note to them. It's a dinky little church. So Philadelphia was more kind of a common place, and it was the gateway to the east, and Laodicea was a little too far south for that. It was also located near a line of active volcanoes. Now, that just seems like a stupid place, right, to build. Clearly, well, who would build in an earthquake zone? I mean, who would do that, right? I mean, that's just dumb. Which, there are two good things, though, that came from that. One of them was it resulted in highly fertile soil for grapes. So that's one thing that came from it. It was very, very fertile soil. It produced wonderful grapes, which oftentimes an area that's got some volcanic soil in it will do. And it caused the viticulture. I'm sure you don't really spend a lot of time studying all of that. And viticulture was the industry of the city, and that was the production of grapes. And so they had a lot of products that came from grapes and from grapevines and all those kinds of things. And also, obviously, it was a big wine-producing area. It was one of the greatest wine-producing areas, and even to this day, there are large vineyards that are out in this section. And so it was very lucrative for the entire region. Philadelphia was the Napa Valley of its day. And so Philadelphia was, as I note, repetitively, by the way, in letter C, built near volcanoes. This instability, though, brought devastating earthquakes because, like I said before, who would be so stupid as to build an earthquake zone? In 17 and 23 AD, there were gigantic earthquakes that destroyed the city, and then there were lots of aftershocks. And the way that they built in the ancient world is not anything like we build in California today. We have so many earthquake codes and earthquake requirements, and yes, stuff does fall down when we have an earthquake. But any of us who have lived here for a long time, and I've been here my whole life, know that what they show on television is always the one block that fell down, isn't it? The whole area is still standing. Largely, we're okay. I mean, a few supermarkets have taken it bad, but generally speaking, that's the place that they're going to focus in on, is the one block that has, you know, dropped a building or something bad has happened, or, you know, it's like in a storm. What do they find? They find the one tree in a 50 square mile area that crushed a house or dropped on a car. And then they show it, and all of your friends from back east in the Midwest are calling you asking, what has happened in Armageddon, kind of thing. And so, we all know that we have lived through much of that. And so these earthquakes, though, back in, you know, ancient history, these were devastating. And these homes that they built were barely standing by themselves. And so as they built this stuff, if there was an earthquake, I mean, there was nothing stopping it from going down. This is like a house of cards for most of these places. So the people did not feel safe, and most of them moved out and lived in little shacks out in the vineyards. They lived out in the countryside. The worst thing that could fall down on them was a few leaves from their roof and that kind of thing. That's all that they had. So a lot of people lived out in the open countryside. It was very instable, very shaky ground that they lived on. Well, Rome's Emperor Tiberius rebuilt Philadelphia after one of the major earthquakes, and the city was renamed Neo Caesarea, which is literally New City of Caesar, because Rome had helped out so much, and they wanted to honor Rome, and they built a statue to Tiberius and placed it back in Rome, and they renamed the city, and they were very, very high on Rome. And then there was a new emperor, and his name was Domitian. Right around the time that John wrote the book of Revelation, right around 92 AD, Emperor Domitian issued an edict. They were short on grain in Rome. And so he went to the areas that had the richest agriculture, and he said, I need you to take half of your land, and I need you to turn it into land for grain, and I need you to send a good chunk of that back to Rome. We take care of you militarily. We protect you. So now you have to take half your crops, and you need to direct them back to Rome. Well, one thing that volcanic soil is really bad at is growing grain. It's great at growing grapes, bad at growing grain. And what did this do to the local economy? It devastated it. It laid it low. And many of the businesses that existed in this area were really angry at Rome for doing this edict, which crushed the viticulture economy. They had to do it, but it severely weakened the city and its people, and they just felt victimized. They felt victimized by their government. I know you probably have never felt that, but these people did, all right? They lived in a place where they felt like the government's out of control. We don't know what to do with it, and they're just taking advantage of us. And the edict was so strong, he wanted to make sure it got accomplished, that they made the transition, so he made them burn half of the vineyards that were there. Everybody had to burn half of their vineyard. So that was it, right? It's gone. And they made sure, because of their military forces, they made sure that happened. So it wasn't just like, hey, take half and just, you know, do the grain thing with it. They made them burn half and then replant grain, and it wouldn't grow. So it was pretty bad stuff. The church existed in the middle of this, and if you think the city was powerless, the church was even more powerless. I mean, they were even weaker, because they were kind of new on the scene. So flip your outlines to the back page, number 2, letter A. We'll talk a little bit about the city, the church, and transition into what Jesus is writing to them at the church of Philadelphia. It says in verse 7, to the angel of the church in Philadelphia write, he who is holy, who is true, who has the key of David, who opens and no one will shut, and who shuts and no one opens, says this. Now, that you read that and you're like, wow, what in the world is that talking about? I don't remember that at all from chapter 1. I do remember keys. I remember keys to death and Hades. I remember that. But the key of David, what is that talking about? Those of you that are cheaters are now looking in your column and you are figuring out that it's Isaiah 22:22. But I already have that written down here, so let's take a look. Number two, letter A. The city and church in Philadelphia were powerless in the face of Rome. Into this context, Jesus notes that he is the one that has true power over the nations. And he says to this church, he who is holy, he who is true. Now, that would probably remind you in the first chapter of Jesus Christ, the faithful witness that comes early in the chapter. We'll read that later. Who has the key of David. This would have directed them directly back to Isaiah 22:22. I'm going to read it for you. Then I will set the key of the house of David on his shoulder. And when he opens, no one will shut. When he shuts, no one will open. This was a messianic, and by messianic I mean a prophecy about the Messiah that they were looking forward to. Almost always, when you mention King David in the New Testament, it's referring to a messianic prophecy from the Old Testament. It should be one of those things that all of you realize, all of you connect with for the rest of your lives. Whenever David is mentioned in the New Testament, you should think to yourself, oh, that's a messianic prophecy right there. That's always mentioning something from the Old Testament that I need to figure out so that I can see what the Messiah prophecy is. You remember Jesus' last name was not Christ, right? That's actually a title. That's actually a title. It should be, we should think of it as Jesus the Christ. Christ is a translation into Greek of Messiah. Christos, the Messiah, the chosen one, all right? The one that has been predicted throughout all of history. Jesus was the Christ. And we've just shortened it and called it Jesus Christ to say Jesus the Messiah. So messianic prophecies are about Jesus. And now Jesus here is saying, he who is holy, who is true, who has the key of David. Well, that's a powerful key to have because it holds the key to the covenant. It holds the key of promise from the Old Testament, that's the royal lineage that the Messiah was going to come from. This key is critical for us because that means that the person that can open that door into the covenant, into the promise, into relationship with God, he would be a very significant person. That's clearly the Messiah. That's clearly a messianic title. And so as they read this, coming from their place of a lack of power, they would think, wow, Jesus Christ has the real power. Rome has kicked our doors down, but Jesus Christ is saying he can open the door and no one will shut it. He who shuts and no one opens says this. In other words, he has the power, right, over the door. This is like when I'm with my kids and we're goofing around in the house and they try to run away from me and they try to slam the door and hold it with their bodies. And what do? I simply push it open and I hear them giggling on the other side. Ah, woo, ah, ah, you know, trying to get out of the way of the door because they can't stop me from opening the door. I weigh over 200 pounds. They're like little tiny people, all right? If I want to push a door open, I can push a door open. This is what Jesus Christ is saying. If I open the door, nobody's going to shut it on me. If I close the door, nobody can open it on me. That is power in every possible way to a city that has been devastated, that has had their lives just ruined, not only by earthquakes, but now by the very people that saved them, that they named their whole city after. Now they've come in and ruined their economy. This symbol of the key, letter B, again, it'll probably remind you of Revelation 1:18, the key to Hades and to death, and the permanently open door that is mentioned in that verse and is also mentioned in the next verse, asserts Jesus' authority over both the physical world, referring to Domitian, and throughout the spiritual and heavenly realm. Jesus and no one else is truly powerful. He says in verse 8, I know your deeds. Behold, I have put before you an open door which no one can shut. Do you hear that? Does he mention that he shuts the door and no one can? No, now I have put before you, church, I have put before you an open door. And nobody can shut it. What I'm about to talk about, what I am providing to you, it is open and no one's going to take it away. I know your deeds, And I know what you need to have confidence in. So I'm going to share some things with you that are going to give you great hope. They're going to give you great confidence that in the midst of what you're dealing with, this should be very satisfying to your soul. No one else, only Jesus, is truly powerful. Take a look at letter C. The Philadelphian church has been faithful in both word and in deed to Jesus. And Jesus assures them that his door of promise will always be kept open for them. Look at verse 8. I know your deeds. Behold, I have put this open door, which no one can shut, because you have only a little bit of power. But you have kept my word, and you have not denied my name. Now, here comes the hinge pin. Why is it important for them to have an open door? Here it comes. Behold, verse 9. I will cause those of the synagogue of Satan, that should remind you of a previous set of verses, who say that they are Jews, but are not, they lie. I will make them come and bow down at your feet. I will make them know that I have loved you. Letter D. Once again, the local Jews are pictured as a synagogue of Satan. Why is that? Because they call Jesus a false Messiah. And they call all of his followers false Israelites. You guys are not following the Messiah. You guys are false Israelites. You're pretending to be true. You're pretending to get in. You're pretending that you come from a Jewish background, but you don't. Your Messiah was killed on a cross, hung on a tree. Is there anything more shameful? He was killed naked. Are you kidding me? That's the guy you follow? Who does Jesus say he is here? I'm alive. And I'm kicking open that door. Now remember, he also said he can shut the door, which is going to be an interesting thing that he brings in later. But he establishes this messianic prophecy from Isaiah 22 that says that he is the powerful one. And this has been prophesied since when? Since Isaiah. He's connecting these two things and he's saying, this has been my plan all along. This little church in Philadelphia, this little insignificant weak church in Philadelphia is experiencing Jesus opening the door to them. And now he's addressing the very source of their oppression in town. These people that tell them, you're not really a follower of Jesus, or you're not really a follower of God. You're not really true to this nation of Israel. You are kidding yourself. You are not true Israelites, and your Messiah, he will not lead you to God. For a new group of new Christians in this unstable town, it's even more instability. And Jesus Christ clarifies, for those who reject the Messiah, that door is closed. See, this is where the power of him being able to close the door comes in. Behold, I will cause those of the synagogue of Satan who say that they are Jews and are not, but are lying, I will make them come and bow down at your feet. I will make them know that I have loved you. Almost a direct quote from Isaiah 60:14. That God will bring in the nations to his people and they will bow at the feet of those he has loved. They will bow at the feet of those who are his true followers. Now the church is being included as true Israel, as truly part of Father Abraham. That even we who are Gentiles, in other words, not national Jews, not part of the chosen people, now we are included as God's chosen ones. Now we are part of the commonwealth, as it says in another part of the Bible, the commonwealth of Israel. Now I just want to point out to you that there are verses that keep Israel distinctive in the Bible as a nation. There are verses that keep the church distinctive in the Bible. And then there are verses that put the two groups together as kind of being one unified whole as God's chosen people, where there is no distinction. You can't tell the difference between Israel and the church and the church and Israel. And it can be very, very confusing. This is one of those verses that puts it all together. And it's making a distinction that there, within the people of God, there are just people that follow the Messiah. And so this is one unified group. I don't want you to get too wrapped up in like, well, who's he talking about here and there? And what's this all about? What's that all about? John Caraboe is going a great, he's doing a great Bible study in Romans on Sunday mornings. That question is really, really well answered in that Bible study. But right here where we're going, we will talk about that further on in the book, the difference between national Israel and the church and that kind of thing. We will get to that, but this isn't going to be the place that we're going to do it. Let's just say that in this place in Revelation, we're talking about, all he's saying is, those people that say that I'm not the real Messiah, those people that are calling you false Israelites, they will bow to you because you are my chosen people. And it would have just vividly brought out Isaiah 60:13. It would have been or Isaiah 60:14. It would have been a vivid reminder to them that, oh, that's what he's talking about. And in fact, if you take the Isaiah 22:22 passage, I will set the key of the house of David on his shoulder. When he opens, nobody will shut. And when he shuts, no one will open. Now listen to this. I will drive him like a peg into a firm place or post, and he will become a throne of glory to his father's house. That's pretty easy to understand as the Messiah, isn't it? So they will hang on him all the glory of his father's house, offspring and issue, everything that comes from it. All of the least of the vessels, from the bowls to all the jars. In other words, all the kingdom will be set on him. In that day, declares the Lord of hosts, the peg driven in a firm place will give way. Literally, the word picture in Hebrew is it will be sheared off. It will even break off and it will fall. This is the death of Jesus Christ. The very people that hang the glory on the Messiah are going to shear the peg away. And the load that hangs on it will be cut off. Now see, from our New Testament perspective and from these verses from Revelation, we can see what's being talked about here. Those that were of the glory of the house of the Lord, they will be cut off. For the Lord himself has spoken. This is what those verses are talking about. This is what Jesus Christ is referring to in Revelation chapter 3. That tremendous, altering, crazy stuff is happening. And it's happening through Jesus. The Jews have gone from being true to the Messiah to now being actually the synagogue of Satan. They think they're in, but in actuality, they're wrong. And he says, I will make them come and bow at your feet. This is a picture in Philadelphia, letter E, of reversal. It's the whole idea in Philadelphia is one of reversal. The weak are becoming strong. The authorities become the subjects. Those who think they are secure are actually not secure. And those who have received rejection from others will actually receive open reception. They get to walk through the door. This time of testing on earth will clarify who has that really true, faithful perseverance. I just want to pause here and just say, I hope that this encourages you. Or are you experiencing weakness for yourself or for a friend? Are you broken because of what's going on in your own family? What's going on with your kids? What's going on with your parents? What's going on in your life? Are you broken by just the events that have gone on right here at the church? Do you feel like it's just overwhelming to your soul and that it's just... You know, I told the guys as we were praying this morning, I walk in here this morning and I just feel emotionally drained. I just feel a little bit empty inside. And I know many of you feel the same way. These are difficult days. I know some of you, before any of this happened, felt that way. And some of this stuff is too much to even engage because it's just overwhelming. These verses should give us a good idea of what Jesus Christ is doing in the midst of our lives. He holds promise open for us and invites us to keep walking towards him. I know you are very weak. I know you only have a little strength. Keep coming. Please be faithful. Continue to do what you're doing. Come on. Jesus Christ compels us to be filled with hope because of his strength. He compels us to come forward because of who he is. He compels us to take our eyes off of the circumstances that we're in, the synagogue of Satan, where people lie. And he compels us to say, raise your eyes and keep them on me. Look at me. Keep your eyes on me, Jesus says. Remember Jesus from chapter 1? That's who is fighting for you. That's the guy. Don't get caught in the midst of this world and its difficulties and the sin and the selfishness and the overwhelmingness of all of that. Keep your eyes on Jesus. To the shaky and weak church, number 3, letter A, in Philadelphia, Jesus states that he is coming quickly. I'll start in verse 10. Because you have kept this word of my perseverance, I will keep you from the hour of testing. That hour which is about to come upon the whole earth to test those who dwell on the earth. We'll talk a lot about that in our growth groups this week. I am coming quickly. Hold fast what you have so that no one will take your crown. Keep your eyes fixed on me, Jesus says. Hold fast, another phrase for be faithful. Be an overcomer, another phrase for be faithful. Don't lose heart, another phrase for being faithful. Jesus Christ says, I am coming quickly to rescue you. Now, to the Church of Philadelphia, right? What does that mean for some of them? That some of them may die. And Jesus Christ says, do not let your heart be troubled. I'm coming to you even quicker. I am coming quickly. If you move out of that world, you move into my arms. Do not lose hope. It is a compassionate assurance to engage in faithful living. Hold fast to what you have so that no one will take your crown. Jesus Christ keeps that reward out there in mind. And for this weak church, for those of us right now that are the weak and the weary, God reminds that he will make his church the very pillars of the heavenly temple. We will talk a lot more about this later, but I do want you to see that the disciples of Jesus Christ, the earliest church, and the church in general are literally pictured in symbolic language as being the very foundation that Jerusalem is based on. It's the very foundation that Jerusalem, the city of God, is built on in the New Testament. We'll develop that more, but just know that when he says things like this, he is speaking of both a literal city, and he's also speaking of just a word picture of that city is based on my church and my people and those who are faithful to the Messiah. And so he is speaking of us being literal, like foundational pillars and bricks and part of that edifice that he is putting together. For this weak and weary church, God reminds that he will make his church the very pillars of the heavenly temple, secure and marked by the name of the Lamb, with a new and redeemed future. For he who overcomes, verse 12, I will make him a pillar in the temple of my God, and he will not go out from it anymore. He will not be sent out like you have been in the synagogue. You will be in and you will not leave. My presence will never depart. And I will write on him the name of my God. You will not be marked by the name of a city. You will not be marked by the name of Satan. You will be marked by the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, the New Jerusalem, which comes down out of heaven from my God and my new name. Did you hear name in there a little bit? You should probably pay attention to that. Whenever there's that much repetition in such a short period of time, you should note that that's important. Names in the book of Revelation are very important. There is a mark of the beast being named by the beast, and there is a mark of the Lamb being named by the Lamb. What do the faithful receive? Woohoo! Mark of the Lamb, right here. All right? Well, right here in several other locations. This is important that we will be marked, we will be known by by Jesus, a new and redeemed future. This urgency, letter C, of I am coming quickly, leads each of us into kind of an anticipatory way of living, keeping our eyes on the prize. Note that the prize is not found in all the benefits, but in the overcomer's stable relationship with Jesus. It's not, you don't have to get too fixated on like, yeah, I'm working on my rewards. You might notice that if you're faithful, everybody kind of gets the same reward. And you know what you're going to see at another part of the Bible? Everybody throws their crowns in front of the throne of God anyway. All right. So you're just getting stuff to throw. So it's almost like, you know, buying nice cars and having flat screens and all that stuff that many of us have. You do realize, right? At the end of time, what do we say? It's all going to burn. They don't have like trailers behind hearses, right? Like so you can take it as you're going. No, that doesn't happen, right? It's going to be gone. You come into the world with nothing. What do you leave it with? Nothing. Except your relationship with Jesus. That's it. That's what you got. You got a relationship with Jesus. So those of you that just go, man, Billy Graham, he's just going to have the biggest mansion in heaven. You're living next door, okay? Don't worry about it. Like, quit freaking out. This is all assured to the followers of Jesus Christ, the faithful. We are to live with Jesus in mind. Keep your eyes on the prize. Who's the prize? It's Jesus. It's all about Jesus. If you have not heard that message yet in the book of Revelation, you are stubbornly not listening. It is all about Jesus. Chapter 1. Let's not miss that. Hope in Him. There's one thing I want our church to know this morning. It's that our hope is in Jesus Christ. We do not stumble into Philadelphia on this weekend without the movement of the Holy Spirit. We do not come here by mistake. God has known, as He always knows when we preach through a book, He knows right where we'll be. He knows right where we'll be at. And He knows right what to say to us. And this is Christ's message for a week and seemingly unstable church. For all those who are broken and weary. I just looked over at the Thompson family and I think of Daniel, and that happened a little bit earlier, but I just, for all of us here who are broken and weary, hope in Jesus. You will not regret putting your hope in Jesus. You will always regret trying to handle these things on your own. You will never regret trusting in Jesus Christ. Put your confidence in Him. The worship team's going to come up. Give us the opportunity this morning to just allow Jesus to minister to us. Just allow Jesus to pour Himself into our experience in our hearts. As you sing the words of these songs, I pray that you are also being ministered to by the Holy Spirit, and that as we stand to sing this morning, we would also be raising our eyes up and setting them on Jesus Christ. So bring the stuff that you know in your life is that heavy burden, is that thing that you're just like, Jesus, when I think of burden, this is what I think of. Whether it be your sin or whether it be circumstance, bring it to Him now. And set it at His feet. And make a habit of bringing these things to Him and allowing Him to deal with them. Jesus promises you. He promises you that He will be faithful. And He asks for a faithful response in return. Let's stand as we worship Him this morning.